New Southerners, a conversation with writer Brent Wade, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Novelist Brent Wade is here now to read from and talk about his book, Company Man, a story of race and corporate culture in contemporary America.
The attitudes that belied these actions were not new ones for us. They had been engendered through the accretion of a history and experience we were no longer willing to enjoy. We were challenging our alienness, marching, singing, refusing all the old capitulations. And I guess if it was overstated, it was because it had been pent up for so long, for fear of what it might elicit. But didn't it begin that way in the field song some ancestors sang in their new jaundiced tongues? There was a certain subversiveness about airing such things in the post-Birmingham 60s. Now the master understood what those work songs had been about, because it ran counter to the larger ideals of fairness, justice, and morality that other Americans had believed they as a nation exemplified. To some, we became a nagging, indelible stain on that claim.
Writer Brent Wade, reading from his novel, Company Man. He'll be back in just a moment to talk about his book, A Story of Race and Corporate Culture in Present-Day America. This program is Part 11 of New Southerners, a continuing series highlighting the work of contemporary Southern writers. Support for New Southerners comes from a major grant from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Because the growth of a sizable black middle class is largely recent in American society, portraits of black professionals are relatively new in American fiction. An example is Company Man, the work of first-time novelist Brent Wade. Brent Wade is here now with Part 11 of New Southerners, an ongoing series highlighting the work of contemporary Southern writers. Set in the border state of Maryland, in and around present-day Baltimore, Company Man tells the story of Billy Covington, an ambitious newcomer to corporate culture. But because he's black, Billy faces more than long hours and competition within the ranks. He must also strive to maintain his personal integrity while battling to achieve professional acceptance. It's a battle that he wins, but only up to a point. Company Man takes the form of a letter Billy writes to a friend. Looking back on a turning point that's both professional and deeply personal, he reflects on the primitive and the modern in his own disposition, on race as a shaping factor in his life, and on the emotional and sexual expression of power. He contemplates his grandparents, his beautiful and well-educated wife and her family, and his corporate colleagues. Doing so, Billy Covington explores the pressures that propel him to compete in an atmosphere dominated by white people, one in which he's both insider and outsider. The high-tech world of Company Man at first seems distant from traditional themes of Southern fiction. Yet in its treatment of race, family, and the influence of the past upon the present, Brent Wade's novel offers a contemporary Southern perspective on American society.
It's about belonging and power and how one accommodates a personality that isn't the conformist personalities in some ways into an environment of conformity and how that conformity affects people. I mean, there is a racial dynamic to the book, obviously. I mean, I'm a black man. That dynamic is, you know, as much a part of me as my black eyes.
Sure.
But at the same time, the story is a larger story. The canvas has more to do with race. It's more human nature. It's about the atmosphere and the culture of conformity, how people conform, feelings of alienness, alienation. I like to use that term alienness. It's kind of my own little word.
Right.
It's about how people adapt in those types of environments.
I want to ask you to read for me here now. I want you to read a passage about Paula, who is Billy Covington's spouse. Here's a passage about Paula as the ideal corporate wife. Will you read for me?
Sure. Paula played her role with abandon so well, in fact, that I'm not really sure when it stopped being an act. But here again we observe the trick of artifice. I'm speaking again of our tendency to take on a role and then wake up one morning and find that the role has taken us over. You lose track of what came first. Case in point, Paula never shrank from her role as beautiful corporate wife. It was a new part, that of the black corporate wife, so there was a kind of opening night anticipation from the audience. Perhaps that partially explains the strength of Paul's performance, because, Lord, was she good at it. I was in tow, struck by her confidence, her odd grace, and well-to-do southern black woman's sense of pragmatism. In 14 years of marriage, I've never seen her bend down from the waist. A small thing, I know, but it makes her movements to retrieve anything from the floor take the form of a curtsy. There's a way she says things, too. Hot tea tastes better out of a thin-lipped cup, or only homely spinster women wear white shoes for formal dress. There was a logic in all of that, inaccessible to me, but so stark and clear and dead-center true in the way it made her work, that I fell in love first with her bearing, her presence, and then with her. She would bring the same peculiar poise to the role of the engaging corporate wife.
Brent Wade, we're talking about your novel, Company Man. Let's turn to another reading from your book here. You have a ghost in this book. It's Billy's grandma. Tell me about her briefly, and then I'll ask you to read.
She is like the grandmother I think we've all had, especially in the black community. There seems to be this tradition of the black grandmother, or the black grandparent, as being kind of all-knowing and wonderful and warm and sweet.
You believe that?
Well, my grandmother was certainly all those things, right. But at the same time, our grandparents also told us a lot of things that were just out and out ridiculous.
Uh-huh.
And we find ourselves still acting on those things sometimes, despite ourselves, even though they make no logical sense, or maybe they made logical sense in 1895, but... here in the end of the 20th century, they don't make a lot of sense anymore.
All right, well, here again, Brent, I want you to read to me from your novel, Company Man. Here's a passage about Billy Cummington's grandma. Read for me.
Okay. My grandmother called it niggerish. Her word for anything that, as she saw it, sits back colored folks. I'm sure by now I would represent quite a setback for her. If she were alive today, she'd stroll in here, hug me, kiss me, and say, "Boy, what niggerish mess you in now." It was a word of her generation, although my actions are haunted still by her definitions. A legacy from our self-hating, keep-grinning, shoe-shuffling, make-no-waves past. It was the context of all the judgments she made upon me, the little orphan grandchild who she would adamantly raise to be an educated man. If I was dancing to the radio, singing along with a record, or laughing loudly, anything that might draw attention, my grandmother called it niggerish. I've come to believe now that what she dreamt for was my metamorphosis into a generic, a man devoid of any cultural affiliation, of any nuance to point to obligations and ties that might be seen as different. Different was always pejorative to her. Disassociating ourselves from the semblance of a culture we had garnered and pieced together was, in her eyes, our price, our dowry, for the privilege of mingling unfettered among the huddled masses. What she couldn't appreciate was that for us, Ellis Island is little more than an illusion, Plymouth Rock an allegory whose significance hovers above the border of irrelevance and myth. And what I didn't understand about the whites I encountered was that they held similar sentiments about the industry of chattel and auction blocks of colonial America. Perhaps this is where it really begins.
Brent Wade, we're talking about your novel, Company Man. Again, it's a book about assimilation, who's on the inside, who's on the outside. Your lead character, Billy Cummington, has really gone through some sad circumstances. He's writing this novel from a hospital bed.
Mm-hmm.
He's writing to a friend of his, a guy named Paul,
right,
who is himself an outsider. He has revealed to the community that he's gay. What has happened to Billy to put him into that hospital bed? Now, can you tell me about that briefly?
Well, it's without giving away too much of the book, it's one of the conflicts in the book is how he's going to resolve this problem he has at work that really forces him, in the good old American fashion of polarization, it forces him to take a position where there can be no middle. He's given two choices, essentially. I call it the binary nature of American life,
right,
you know, for us or against us. And this position throws him in a bit of turmoil, to put it mildly. He also has some personal problems going on at home,
uh-huh,
in the relationship between he and Paula, that kind of stop him I guess, and where he had been going along in his career.
Yeah, and this is a real tough knot to unravel because it involves sex. It involves their relationship in terms of what you call power, gender relations.
Right.
It's a reflection of her life in the wide world, his life in the corporate world. And in a way, it takes us back to that passage you read us about the grandma. You're going to be one thing or the other. You can't get to that middle ground.
And in the way the grandmother put that, without understanding some of the complexities of it that make the either-or decision really a lose situation no matter what choice he makes, because there is so much inherent complexity in each choice, yet she's very right and very true and very on target in some of the things she says about how things are perceived and, you know, where success lies and where it doesn't lie. She just... There was no intellectualization in any of what she said. She saw it all as being from experience and being practical.
Yeah, she's talking from the heart.
She's talking.
You just used the word success. The company that your lead character, Billy Covington, works for in Company Man is called Veritech.
That's right.
Man, that sounds like something out of Darth Vader, though. Yeah. I congratulate you. This is the big, sprawling monster company. The guy that runs it is a man named Haviland.
Right.
Let me put it to you directly. Is Haviland a racist? Well, help me unpack that.
Well, again, that's one of those questions that are more complex than they seem. I mean, clearly some of his actions could be interpreted as being racist.
Uh-huh.
I think that rather than racist, the I guess it's like quality. It's one of those terms that are so overused it becomes kind of meaningless now. I think what most white Americans indulge in sometimes discreetly and not so discreetly is what I would call white supremacy. Uh-huh. This kind of underlying belief, kind of implicit in a lot of things, that black people are inferior in large part to whites. I mean, it can be a belief that polite people have in polite society, but it's there tacitly in the culture. And Haviland is a part of that culture. You know, nothing that goes on in a corporation is any different than what goes on in a larger culture.
Mm-hmm.
Haviland likes Billy, though, and Billy admires Haviland because he is a brilliant businessman. He's made the company a lot of money. He's kept a lot of people employed through his shrewdness. He makes decisions based on what he thinks is going to be good business. And whether or not that makes him a racist, I think is a question the reader has to ponder. I don't try to draw characters as being villains and good guys because I really don't believe in that sort of thing. I think in the context of life, we pass in and out of decisions that can be interpreted in a lot of different ways.
Right.
And this is, you know, it's up to the reader to determine what they think John Haviland is. But I certainly don't want to paint him as a total villain. There are no Darth Vaders in my fictional world.
Let's step back from the plot of Company Man itself, Brent Waite, and talk to me about your work as a Southern writer. Now, I told you over dinner last night that you don't sound to me like a Southerner, and yet you say, hey, wait a minute, man, I grew up in Maryland, and that's a Southern. Southern state. You think of yourself as a Southern writer?
Yeah, I do, in a sense. I mean, I don't like labels per se, but Maryland has always been thought of by my family and by me as a Southern state. I mean, we have been there for as many generations as we can go back in any family. I mean, the descendants of people who worked tobacco fields, the descendants of slaves. And so for me, when I read Southern fiction, particularly Faulkner or, you know, even Walker Percy, who some of his books I like quite a bit, to me the culture is a recognizable culture, the culture of rural, agrarian America, where there are these kind of divisions between the races. But there is a common culture, in a sense, that all the people share.
Yeah.
And that was how I grew up.
Well, now, you know, it's a commonplace, Brent, that the South has changed, that it is, the Dixieization of America or the Americanization of Dixie. You can pick your formula there. Your book, in a way, represents the biggest changes that have occurred in the South. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, here your character, Billy Covington, this young black guy, is working for this major company. He's a senior manager. He's not emptying the trash buckets here. I mean, he's a big shot with this company. He represents the results, the best of what could come out of the civil rights movement. Now, is that what the South stands for you today?
Well, some people, some readers might interpret Billy Covington as being nothing more than a high-paid token.
Right.
That is an interpretation that the reader can make. And the
is
only,
that how you created him as a character?
I tried to create him as I saw these things happening in companies. I tried to create him as realistically as I could. And, you know, again, these are questions of interpretation and perspective. I mean, the employers may not see him that way at all. But when you look at who has power in a company, you start understanding who are the real players and who are placekeepers.
All right, but now, is this a question of race relations, Brent, or is this a question of human relations?
Well, that's where it gets complicated, because certainly it is about race, but on a larger scale, if you were to move out of the myopic confines that we look at these things in, if you went to Ireland, for instance, and looked at relations between the British and the Irish, to a black person, I mean, to me it seems odd that when you listen to the evening news that, you know, Dan Rather, whoever, will talk about black-on-black violence in Soweto or South Africa. But the violence between the Irish and the English would never be described as white-on-white violence, or in Yugoslavia, for that matter. But yeah, for us, for blacks, it looks like that. And my point is, it's human nature. It's the nature of people in power to use power to try to dominate other people.
Well, again, to come back to your book, and at the same time to talk about your life as a Southern writer and what Southern fiction is doing in the 1990s, who's to blame for the pressures that Billy Covington feels? I mean, are these demons that he has to face inside himself, or are they the demons of society?
Again, another intensely complex question, because we do run on a program that's part nature and part nurture. I mean, this is Brent Wade's personal belief. And there are conflicts between that nurture and nature program. I mean, I do think that we are creatures of the natural world, first and foremost, and that the way we are now as human beings, the way our brains are wired, the way we react, are behaviors that were dictated through a million or so years of evolution. And for the last 5,000 years, we find ourselves in a community of thousands of people. And for the last couple hundred years, we found ourselves in communities of millions of people, and that puts certain pressure on the earlier programming. And you know, I think the conflicts are inherent conflicts of human nature in self. It's the self trying to define himself. It's the individual struggling to emerge in a culture of conformity.
Do you think you're going to change society as a Southern writer, Brent Wade? I mean, do you look from your word processor and you think, I got a message here, and I don't want to be crude about it as a novelist, of course. I have my art to be loyal to. Do you change the world?
Is it okay to say hell no on the radio? No, I'm not a crusader. I'm not trying to be didactic. I'm trying to... I like to ask questions. You know, there's an old joke about the philosopher and the priest, and the philosopher says to the priest, "You're like a blind man in a dark room looking for a black cat that isn't there." And the priest says to the philosopher, "Yeah, but the difference between me and you is that I would find it."
Uh-huh.
You know, I think a writer is a person who has to really look for that black cat. The writer is a person who has to ask questions. I'm not trying to lead anyone. I'm not running for political office. I'm interested in people thinking about some of these things in more complex ways.
Is race the black cat of the 20th century? Does it continue to be?
The intersection of race and humanity. You know, race is a subset of human nature. People dominate each other. People abuse each other. People try to make other people subservient. Sometimes race is a factor. It has more to do with how you define yourself. Yeah, you can be the same race and define yourself. Call yourself Catholic, call yourself Protestant, call yourself Jew, call yourself Arab. It's the way you define yourself, and these definitions are what we hold on to. You know, these clashes, again, you know, I mentioned the Soweto and the Ireland and England. They're not about race so much as they are about a people trying to hold on to a definition of themselves that is, you know, being... they feel endangered,
right,
or threatened by another group, maybe a more powerful group of people. Well, and that's the same dynamic that goes on here.
Another way to say that is looking to the past, hanging on to the past. And again, this is, I told you a moment ago, you don't sound like a Southern writer, but you call yourself a Southern writer. And that's one of the hallmarks of Southern fiction, is that we look backward and forward at the same time. You doing that in Company Man?
Yeah, I think you have to. I think the past is a continuum. You know, William Faulkner, who is one of my favorite writers, said once that no one person could look at the truth directly because it would blind them.
Uh-huh.
And all I'm trying to present is the complexity in a situation, it gets too often glossed over.
Now, what is the truth, as it were, quote unquote, of Company Man? Is it do we read this novel fundamentally pessimistic about the relationship between the races, whether we're speaking of the South or the whole country?
Race is a factor in this book, obviously. To me, it's more a story about alienation. I mean, race certainly a major factor in this person's alienation, but it's an alienation that a white person in a company could understand also.
Do you feel comfortable as a black male working in a large American corporation that's dominated by white people? What I'm leading you to here, Brent, is how much of this book is your life?
Oh, well, I'm not Billy Covington, but I understand Billy Covington. I've met people who I think are Billy Covington. I've done readings in cities where white readers have come up and said, I really liked your book, but, as a white person working for a large company, I feel this same way.
Do I have to be a black person really to appreciate Billy Covington?
Certain aspects, certain things like the grandmother and the culture she comes out of and the legacy of where you're from, it would be like me asking someone, do I have to be you to appreciate your family, where you came from?
The answer is yes.
Of course, in some ways. But there's, again, the larger human nature story, the universal story of our humanity is that conformity is difficult for everyone. You know, not every white person working for a large company is the CEO.
Right.
In fact, most aren't. You know, most are in the same boat. Really, race complicates that. It's the same thing that happens among poor whites and poor blacks in the South, in that they are really in the same boat. But there is no advocate for the poor whites because they refuse to see themselves as being in the same boat as the blacks. There is no Jesse Jackson. I mean, that's the only example I can think of. But there is no Jesse Jackson for poor whites. And the ones that propose to be their advocates are people who have no political currency. David Duke. Yep. Someone like that. When the real issue is if these people could pool their resources, could pool their plight together, they would be incredibly powerful. But again, race separates them.
You're something of a sociologist as well as a novelist, Brent Wade. Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Mm-hmm. As you look around our American popular culture, we have debates about multiculturalism in our educational system. We have national spectacles like Rodney King and Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas. We have success stories like Bill Cosby. Do these things, how do they bounce off of your mind as a writer? How do you take all of that into account?
I put that back in the pool of human behavior, pool of human nature. I mean, we have to look outside of ourselves, look outside of this country for some of the answers to some of the things that have perplexed us. There is certainly a history in America of servitude and inferiority and power when it comes to relations of blacks and whites. But the question is really a larger question. I mean, if you looked in Central and South America, at the Aztecs and the Mayans, before the conquistadors came, there were wars. The Aztecs were basically the victors of over the Mayans.
So you're telling us, don't think monolithically.
Don't think monolithically. Don't think myopically that the canvas of race is a real canvas, but it is the smaller canvas, and that the larger canvas is how we behave and why there seems to be this tendency to use and abuse power when it's available.
Well, Brent, I'm going to ask you to read for me one more time here. This is a passage toward the end of your book, Company Man, and here we're really getting to the nub of what's going on in the mind of Billy Covington, your lead character.
Yes.
Set this up for me.
This is a passage about identity, again. I'm not trying to minimize the importance of race in this, but this is about identity. This is Billy coming to a realization about identity,
his own identity. I want to hear you read this.
I had at last reached the end of myself, a place rank with the memories of deprecation and pain. But had my entire life been a pilgrimage to this place? It's where you end up when you divide yourself and is haunted by the ghost of that other, the invisible man I kept interred in the ivory shell. Who was he that we should not have stood together in such a long time? And suddenly the question, gestating for so long, never far from my awareness, began to come to me at that moment. I waited now, feeling it, slowly, slowly. "Who are you?" I whispered inside myself. A voice came back, my voice and not my voice, talking through me. "I am William Billy Bill Covington," it began. And a thought came to me so quickly, Paul, so quickly that I knew instantly, without saying or thinking, what the voice had told me. It said they are who I had always been, no matter who I assumed they were, no matter who I had thought they were not, no matter who they each dreamt I might have been. It didn't matter, because we three are all part of a larger body, this brooding, fecund, unconsumable blackness, a blackness that I now see will never be fully assimilated. It will always stand abject and separate, even to the most well-intentioned, even if only on some discreet level of intuition or observance, distilled in a nanosecond to a heedless reaction. It's the idea of this blackness that they see first, regardless. Blackness as the depreciated reciprocal of whatever whiteness has come to mean. This is who I am. I'm inseparable from this blackness, its history, its weight, its obligations. Yes, obligations. Perhaps this is the real ghost that haunts that place I fear within myself. All pilgrimages lead to choices we are obligated to make.
Writer Brent Wade, reading from his first novel, Company Man. Company Man was originally published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond.